Good afternoon. Happy Sabbath to you all. Certainly great to be back in Fort Worth. We don't get over here as much as we would like to anymore, but I'm certainly glad that we could come over here and fellowship with you all. I didn't realize that they weren't having services here next week, so that gives you all the more reason to come up and hang out with us in Lake Texoma. Don't go to Dallas, go to Lake Texoma. That's the place to be. It's maybe a little warm, but there's a tree canopy. We're outside. It's a good 10 degrees cooler at any given time under the trees. It's a very pleasant way to keep the Sabbath. We're going to have a potluck meal afterwards. And if you want to just come up for the day, you can do that. If you want to come for the whole weekend, come up Friday evening and stay till Sunday. Mr. Hines is going to have his boat on the water. We'll do some water skiing. So I wasn't planning on putting that plug in, but when Mr. Reyes mentioned that y'all weren't going to be here next week, I'm like, yeah, I'm gonna sell the weekend. So it should be a wonderful time. So email me if you want to come. You can come and tell me after services, but I'm not going to remember unless we write it down. So, but if you email me, then we can try to organize how we're going to do the potluck. I'll send information out to your email afterwards. Well, today is the third Sabbath in our count towards Pentecost. The word Pentecost in the Greek literally means count 50. And so three Sabbaths into our count, and we're on day 21. In ancient Israel's history, they would have been somewhere from their, from the emergence of the Red Sea. So, I just gave the little hand signal here. I thought the fan's comfortable, but I was afraid my pages were going to start flying. So, yeah, we can kill that. So in ancient Israel's history, they would have been somewhere from their emergence from the Red Sea, and they're wandering in the wilderness towards Sinai, and eventually coming to Mount Sinai. And I'm going to talk a little bit about Mount Sinai today. The Apostle Paul talked a little bit about Mount Sinai, and we're going to take a look at that. It's going to be in Galatians chapter 4. You don't have to turn there just yet. We'll get there in a moment. But before we do, I'd like to talk about how we deal with the Apostle Paul in general. Now, the Apostle Paul is complicated. Even the Apostle Peter said as much. And it's not just in our modern era that these writings are hard to understand. It's always been that way in God's church. You know, do you think there's always been a debate in God's church about law and grace, for example? Did people in the first century believe that God's grace gave them license to disobey God's laws? I'd say probably yes, if you believe what the scriptures say. Let's notice that. We'll start reading in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, if you could turn over there. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. And we can see here in the Apostle Paul's writings to the members of Thessalonica, you know, these being the very first writings of the New Testament. You know, isn't that fascinating? The very first collection of writings that we have preserved for us in forming the New Testament scriptures are the letters to the Thessalonians. And let's notice a problem that is identified by the Apostle Paul this early in God's church. As early as the early 50s AD, we have this warning. And we'll notice it in verse 7, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 7. For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. The mystery of lawlessness. What is that? You know, we have a mystery. It's a teaching. It's a philosophy. It's a competing approach to doctrinal truth, and Paul calls it the mystery of lawlessness. It's a teaching that at its core teaches disobedience to God. Godly values, godly knowledge, God's law. And this competing philosophy is as old as Christianity itself. The Apostle Paul is teaching about it. He's warning against it. It's a mere 20 years from that time that the New Testament church began on that day of Pentecost in AD 31. Just 20 years later, and we have the doctrine of disobedience. For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. And then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming. The coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan, with all powers, signs, and lying wonders, and with all unrighteous deception among those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth, that they might be saved. And for this reason, God will send them strong delusion, that they should believe the lie, that they all may be condemned who did not believe the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness. So we can see that having pleasure in unrighteousness and practicing the mystery of lawlessness are issues that are at the heart and core of the very basic tenets of Christianity, and have been so from the very beginning. But as clear as Paul is here with teaching against lawlessness, there are still those who contend that Paul taught doing away with God's law. You know, that's lawlessness. And I think we can see from reading that passage there in Thessalonians that Paul can't actually believe that. He didn't believe it and he didn't teach it. He did not teach that God's laws are done away. Let's notice a warning that Peter gave us in his latter epistle about Paul. 2 Peter chapter 3, you're probably very familiar with this. This is at the very end of Peter's second epistle, and it's perhaps the very last piece of advice that Peter gives the church. The very last thing that we get to hear from the aging apostle Peter. Let's notice it in verse 14, 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 14. Therefore, beloved, looking forward to these things, be diligent to be found by him in peace, without spot and blameless. And consider that the long suffering of our Lord is salvation, as also our beloved brother Paul, according to the wisdom given to him, has written to you, as also in all his epistles, speaking them of these things, in which are some things hard to understand, which untaught and unstable people twist to their own destruction, as they do also the rest of the scriptures. So what can we learn from that admonition, that last piece of advice that the Apostle Peter gives to the Church of God? Paul's writings are hard to understand. Now, can we accept that? Can you accept in your mind that there are some things about the Apostle Paul's writings that might be difficult for you? Consider who wrote this admonition. You know, Peter was a contemporary of Paul. Peter knew Paul intimately. They were friends. He calls him our beloved brother Paul. They spoke the same language, you know, so there was no loss in translation. You take all that into account when you consider this admonition to all of us concerning Paul's writings. And what is that admonition? Paul is hard to understand. Be careful when you read Paul. So how are some ways that we should approach the Apostle Paul's epistles? Well, point number one, we should be humble. Humble yourself to realize that you don't understand all of Paul's writings flawlessly. I surely don't. It's okay to realize that you don't understand it all. But with patience, with prayerful study, understanding will come. You know, so when you come across something that you can't quite get a grasp on, we'll be willing to put it up on the shelf. Come back to it later. And the second point to realize is that where Paul might be vague, in your mind at least, where he might be vague on a topic or hard to understand, well, oftentimes the rest of the scriptures are more clear. You know, did Paul really teach that it was okay to eat food offered to idols, for example, when the apostles in Acts chapter 15 clearly state that one of the four things that Gentiles should avoid and be careful with concerning their former pagan religion is to avoid food offered to idols? That's what the apostles, one of the four things they said, you need to avoid this. Jesus Christ in his message to the churches at Asia Minor, Revelation chapters 2 and 3, he lists eating food offered to idols as a doctrine of Balaam, and that the people of God should repent of it. You know, I had one friend who suggested to me that perhaps Jesus didn't get the memo from the Apostle Paul, you know, that concerning this subject, you know. Paul was teaching that food offered to idols is no big deal. You know, who cares about food offered to idols? But Jesus Christ, he had a problem with it, so. Well, if you think you know what Paul is saying, but you find that it's in direct contradiction to what the other apostles said, to what Jesus Christ himself said, well, you probably need to rethink your interpretation, your understanding of Paul. Here's an important key I want you to latch on to. Young people, if you're wrestling with the Apostle Paul's writings, I want you to consider this. If you remove Paul's discussion on any given topic from the equation, just set Paul aside, what are you left with? If the doctrine rests solely on the writings of the Apostle Paul, You really need to seriously consider that doctrine. Take the Lord's Supper, for example. Perhaps some of you younger people might think, hey, you know, we want to appear more palatable to the rest of the mainstream. We don't want to appear like a cult. We want to appear less weird. I mean, who wants to be weird if we can avoid it, right? Take the Lord's Supper, for example. Why can't we just call the service of bread and wine the Lord's Supper, like so many others do? That way we can fit in. They take the bread and wine, we take the bread and wine, we're all doing it to commemorate the Lord's death. So why can't we find common ground? You know, why do we have to insist on calling it the Passover when the phrase the Lord's Supper would suffice? So understand, the phrase the Lord's Supper only occurs one time in the scriptures, and that's in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. Now if you remove 1 Corinthians from the equation and just study all the other scriptures related to what occurred on that night, that night when Jesus Christ was betrayed On that night when he assembled with his disciples, when they took the bread and wine, when Jesus Christ washed their feet, if you carefully study all four gospel accounts related to that event, and then you go back to the Hebrew scriptures and you verify precisely why they were gathered together on that specific night, well, there's only one conclusion that you can come to as to what they were doing. They were observing the Passover, without question. Without question. But suddenly Paul makes this one statement and the whole world loses their mind, right? He makes this one statement in one verse to the members of Corinth, and the whole Christian world decides to adopt this phrase, the Lord's Supper. I can't think of a more blatant example of proof texting than the Lord's Supper heresy. And it is a heresy. The Apostle Paul called it a heresy. That's not my interpretation. That ought to give you pause to reconsider. One little snippet from Paul's writing, and suddenly you're doing something totally contrary to everything Jesus Christ and his disciples did, what the Hebrew scriptures taught. Don't fall for that trap. Again, simply remove Paul from the equation, and if you can't find support for your doctrine anywhere else without using your little Paulism, then you need to at least be suspect. You know, Peter's admonition about Paul's writings might apply in that case. Taking bread and wine anytime you choose throughout the year, calling it the Lord's Supper just as a random ceremony, instead of coming together on the 14th day of the first month, according to the Hebrew calendar, calling it the Passover service, well, this would not stand if you removed 1 Corinthians out of the discussion. The idea is not even remotely suggested anywhere else. I gave an entire sermon on that subject. If you're interested, you want to do a deep dive into that, the sermon is in the archive. It's entitled The Lord's Supper Heresy. The Lord's Supper Heresy. I recommend the one I gave in Oklahoma City. That was just before the spring holy days of 2018. I gave it in Dallas, but I revised it a little bit before I went up to Oklahoma City. And that was in 2018. And I checked the archive. It is still there. So the phrase, the Lord's Supper, is a perfect example of twisting the Apostle Paul's hard-to-understand writings into a doctrine of destruction. Because if you follow it to its conclusion, it will lead you to rejecting God's holy days in favor of some made-up ceremony that's done randomly throughout the year. This is a doctrine of the mystery of lawlessness that was spoken of in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. It does away with God's laws. All right, now let's look at one of the Apostle Paul's passages that I have struggled to understand over the years. And no surprise here, we're going to turn over to the book of Galatians. Galatians chapter 4. I'd say that for over 30 years, I couldn't quite put my finger on why Paul would use the term that he did here. And so I had to put it up on the shelf. I'd take it down occasionally. I'd examine it this way and that, and then I'd put it back on the shelf. Because I knew it didn't mean what many in the mainstream thinks it means. I knew it didn't mean what the false teachers were telling us back in 1995. And how did I know that? Well, because the rest of the scriptures are more clear on the subject. Jesus Christ and the other apostles were more clear. Paul himself was more clear in other places. Paul doesn't contradict Paul. What did he tell the Romans? Do we make void the law through faith? Certainly not. On the contrary, we establish the law. That's clear and unmistakable, isn't it? That's Romans chapter 3 and verse 31, a good memory verse. That's not the mystery of lawlessness. That's the doctrine of obedience. But let's notice what Paul says here in Galatians chapter 4 that caused me some sleepless nights over the years. Well, not really sleepless nights, but definitely a bit of cognitive dissonance. And certainly it was a dissonance that was my own shortcoming. It was my lack of understanding. And it's my continued flawed understanding that has me scratching my head from time to time. But let's start reading in verse 21. Galatians chapter 4 and verse 21. Tell me, you who desire to be under the law, do you not hear the law? For it is written that Abraham had two sons, the one by a bondwoman, the other by a free woman. But he who was of the bondwoman was born according to the flesh, and he of the free woman through promise. Which things are symbolic? For these are the two covenants, the one from Mount Sinai, which gives birth to bondage, which is Hagar. For this Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia and corresponds to Jerusalem, which now is, and is in bondage with her children. But the Jerusalem above is free, which is the mother of us all. Chevy mentioned the mother of us all, which is God's church, and is the Jerusalem above. Happy Mother's Day, right? The mother of us all. I just caught that. Now, there are a lot of things that I do understand about Paul's writings that are helpful and instructive here. First of all, I know that the word law is a generic word. It can mean a lot of things. It's translated from the Greek word nomos, and that word is used nearly 200 times in the New Testament. And it's a word that is as equally generic as the English word law. You can use it in a variety of contexts. In fact, it's the same word, or the root word, that forms lawlessness in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. The Greek word for lawlessness in 2 Thessalonians is anomia, and its root word is anomos. Nomos means law, and anomos means without law. Now, was the Apostle Paul clear in 2 Thessalonians as to what he thought of the doctrine of anomia, the mystery of lawlessness? So when Paul asks us here in Galatians chapter 4 and verse 21, "Tell me, you who desire to be under the law," what is Paul asking here? Tell me, you who desire to submit to God's holy and righteous law. You desire to worship God above all other gods. You desire to avoid idolatry. You desire to be faithful to your wife. Oh, that's bondage, you know. Tell me, you who desire to submit to God's law. Okay, so I understand that. I understand that the generic word law can mean a lot of different things at different times. It's the context that establishes what the word means at any given time. In the letter to Romans, Paul says, "For I would not have known sin unless the law said, 'You shall not covet.'" Now, what does the generic word law mean there? Sin is defined as the transgression of God's law. Which law? The law that says, "You shall not covet." I think we know which law that is. I think we can see how the context of the verse there in Romans demonstrates which law that we're talking about. But what is the context here in Galatians? Well, this is where it gets deep, and it gets interesting. You read the whole epistle to the Galatians, and what becomes immediately clear is that Paul is dealing with a specific issue that Gentiles feel compelled to be circumcised. That is the issue. That's the primary and central issue of Galatians. Now, what else do I know about this epistle? Well, back in chapter 1, I know that Paul introduces a unique term that is found nowhere else in the scriptures. And that word is translated into the English word Judaism. Nowhere else do you find the word Judaism except in Galatians chapter 1. We're dealing with Gentiles being taught that they have to become circumcised so that they can fit into the religion known as Judaism. And by doing so, they become justified through the law. And that's another important word you'd have to explore. What is justification? What does that word mean? If I seek to live a life of obedience to God's holy and righteous law from this point forward, does that justify me of my sins? All the things I've done in the past are wiped clean because I decide to live by God's commandments from this point forward. Even the children here know better than that. You decide to obey your parents from, let's say you did something 6 months ago and you didn't get caught, you know, but you know you did something wrong and you feel bad about it, and you know your parents would be very disappointed in you, and 6 months goes by, you didn't get caught, but you still have guilt, and you decide, you know what, from this point forward, I'm never going to do that again. Does that make that thing go away? You've never done that thing that you did 6 months ago? If your parents suddenly find out about it, hey, you did this thing that you weren't supposed to do. Yeah, but I'm not going to do it from this point forward, so it's gone. It's not, that never happened. The children know better. Okay, I kind of went on a ramble there, but. So back in chapter 1, we have that unique term, which is Judaism. And what is justification? I'm trying very hard to skirt these issues without going too deep, because there are whole sermons in here that we could give on any one of these topics, and I only have time to give you one today. Paul's writings are hard to understand, but we don't have to be derailed when we fix in our minds what we do know. Paul is dealing with people who believe that they can be justified, they can be made righteous in God's eyes apart from the sacrifice of Jesus Christ through becoming circumcised and becoming Jewish. That is a false doctrine. But it doesn't mean that we take the opposing definition of the word law. Since Paul rebuked the Galatians for desiring to be under the law, because the opposing definition is lawlessness. The opposite of nomos is anomos. And that is the mystery of lawlessness that Paul rebuked the Thessalonians. All right, so now we've established a few things that we do know. And there's more. There's more that we could establish through careful study. But I want to get into that part that for 30-plus years I did not know. That part that had me scratching my head for a very long time. Mount Sinai gives birth to bondage. I told you we were going to talk about Mount Sinai today. It's a long time to get around to that point. But Mount Sinai gives birth to bondage. Israel, in their history, on this third Sabbath towards Pentecost, is on their way to the foot of Mount Sinai. And it is there where they will enter into a national covenant with the eternal and almighty God. But notice the verse there in verse 24, Galatians chapter 4, which states, Mount Sinai gives birth to bondage, which is Hagar. For this Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia, which corresponds to Jerusalem, which now is, and is in bondage with her children. Now, what do you think of when you hear the word Mount Sinai? What does that mean to you? What icon pops into your mind? Surely we all have icons that pop into our minds when we hear a word, kind of like a little image that appears on a computer screen. And all we need to do is click on that icon, and it expands into what that icon represents. You know, when I say the word Passover, for example, perhaps you see on the computer screen of your mind an icon. It's the icon of a lamb. And all you have to do is click on that, and immediately everything you know about the Passover emerges. Or maybe another icon would be a broken piece of unleavened bread next to a cup of wine. That's another icon that we can click on. It expands into all of our knowledge on the subject of the Passover. How about the return of Jesus Christ? You know, what icon comes to your mind? Maybe a trumpet? Just a small icon that you can click on, and it brings to light all the understanding that's surrounding the return of Jesus Christ. What icon sits on the computer screen of your mind when I say the phrase Mount Sinai? Is it two tablets of stone? Wouldn't that make the perfect little icon for your screen? You know, we could do that. Moses did, after all, bring two tablets of stone down from the mountain off of Mount Sinai. On it were the Ten Commandments, and the people of Israel were required, as a condition to entering that covenant with God, to declare submission to that law. I can still see Charlton Heston standing there with two tablets of stone, right? If you've seen that old movie from the 50s, the two tablets of stone, it's Mount Sinai. But here in Galatians, Paul says Mount Sinai is bondage. Didn't he say that plain as day? Tell me, you who desire to be under the law, do you not hear the law? Mount Sinai gives birth to bondage. God's law gives birth to bondage. And we don't want to be in bondage. Uh-oh. I see a derailment coming up. We're about to go off the tracks. Paul's writings are hard to understand. Paul, why did you have to use the phrase Mount Sinai to make your point here? You know, everyone knows that the icon for Mount Sinai is two tablets of stone. It's the Ten Commandments. And therefore, you must be saying that submitting ourselves to the Ten Commandments is placing ourselves in bondage. Yeah, that can't be right. This is where I start applying the other things that I do know to that cognitive dissonance. The rest of the scriptures don't teach this. The other apostles don't teach this. Jesus Christ does not teach this. Paul himself in other places does not teach this. For I would not have known sin unless the law, the Ten Commandments, said, Thou shalt not covet. The Ten Commandments teaches us what sin is. Do you not know that to whom you present yourselves slaves to obey, you are that one's slaves whom you obey, whether sin leading unto death or of obedience leading unto righteousness? That's from the Apostle Paul in the book of Romans, chapter 6. Now, which one of those competing philosophies is bondage? Sin leading unto death or obedience leading unto righteousness? Submission to and obedience to God's holy and righteous law is not the bondage that Paul is speaking about here in Galatians. But why, Paul? Why did you have to use the phrase Mount Sinai? Because in that computer screen of my mind, I have an icon, and it's two tablets of stone, and that represents Mount Sinai. The Ten Commandments is Mount Sinai. Is it? Maybe my thinking is flawed here. Maybe the problem is me. And for the last 30-plus years, I've been using the wrong icon for Mount Sinai. I think we need to go to the foot of Mount Sinai to figure this out. Let's turn over to Exodus chapter 19. In order to understand what the Apostle Paul meant by Mount Sinai is Hagar, which is bondage, we need to define what Mount Sinai is. And it begins in Exodus chapter 19. We'll start reading in verse 1. Exodus 19 and verse 1, in the third month after the children of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on the same day they came to the wilderness of Sinai. Okay, so we have a starting point, and we'll simply call it Mount Sinai. They came to the wilderness of Sinai, for they had departed from Rephidim, had come to the wilderness of Sinai, and camped in the wilderness. So Israel camped there before the mountain, and Moses went up to God, and the Eternal called to him from the mountain, saying, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the children of Israel, you have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings, and brought you to myself. Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice, and keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all people, for all the earth is mine, and you shall be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak to the children of Israel." So Moses came and called for the elders of the people, and laid before them all these words which the Eternal commanded him. Then all the people answered together and said, "All that the Eternal has spoken we will do." So Moses brought back the words of the people to the Eternal. Okay, so if Mount Sinai is a package deal that stands and falls together, you know, that's what the false teachers were telling us back in 1995. I remember it clearly. Everything that happened at Mount Sinai has to fall with Mount Sinai. The Ten Commandments are products of Mount Sinai, and Mount Sinai is the Old Covenant. It's Hagar, and it's bondage. It all falls at a package deal. Well, if that's true, then tell me, does this fall at Mount Sinai? In verse 5, God says, "If you will obey my voice, then you shall be a special treasure to me." Does obedience to God's voice fall at Mount Sinai? Does God's voice get thrown out? The people of Israel are introduced to the voice of God at Mount Sinai. Shall we consider obedience to that voice as the bondage that Paul was talking about? Folks, this is the mystery of lawlessness. This is what the man of sin is going to be teaching. Obedience to God's voice is bondage. Yes, God gave Israel the Ten Commandments at Mount Sinai, but we all know that the Ten Commandments didn't come into existence at Mount Sinai, right? Just like the voice of God itself didn't originate at Mount Sinai, the Ten Commandments are easily demonstrated to be universal in nature. Even the mainstream knows that. You know, even the false teachers of 1995 knew that. You know, take the law of adultery, for example. Clearly, adultery was understood long before Mount Sinai. Joseph fled from Potiphar's wife because he didn't want to be involved in sin. It was adultery. Joseph knew that. Mount Sinai did not invent the law of adultery, and it would be absurd to think otherwise. Thou shalt not murder did not originate at Mount Sinai. Cain was guilty of murder when he killed his brother Abel. Everyone knows this. And of course, everyone who wants to discard the Ten Commandments because of what they read in Galatians chapter 4, well, they don't really want to discard the Ten Commandments. They want to discard one commandment. They don't have a problem with the other nine. It's just that Sabbath day commandment. That's what's got to go, because that's the one that's all Jewish and stuff, right? Wrong. We go back to Exodus chapter 20, and we actually read the commandment. We discover that the Sabbath commandment is the one that actually gives the reason for the commandment. Not all of God's commandments do that. They don't. You read the commandment, they don't all give the reason why God has given you the commandment. But God does give us the reason about the Sabbath. Why do we keep the Sabbath? Because in 6 days, the Eternal made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, and he rested on the seventh day. Therefore, the Eternal blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. The Sabbath day didn't come into existence at Mount Sinai. It came from creation, just like adultery came from creation, just like murder came from creation. Not only that, we see that even before they got to Mount Sinai, if you went back to Exodus chapter 16, you discover that God commanded Israel to observe the Sabbath before they even got to Mount Sinai. So yes, Moses brought two tablets of stone, the Ten Commandments written on them, and he brought them down from the mountain. That happened at Mount Sinai. But the commandments themselves did not originate at Mount Sinai. See, the icon imagery in my mind was all wrong. It was wrong for me to associate God's law that defines sin, and use it as an icon for Mount Sinai. That was the error in my thinking. And why? Because Paul's writings are hard to understand. Well, what then is it that is unique to Mount Sinai that would perish with the termination of the old covenant? What else was going on at Mount Sinai besides God simply codifying his universal and unchangeable laws of mankind on the two tablets of stone? Well, we had Moses go up to the top of the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. And what happened at that time? Israel sinned. And this wasn't just any old sin. This wasn't all mankind sinned in general and needs forgiveness sin. This was the big sin, or a big sin. This wasn't just a disobedience. This was the disobedience. Israel forged a golden calf and sacrificed it to it before Moses could even finish his 40 days on the mountain. Paul tells us in Galatians that a law was added 430 years after Abraham because of transgression. That was the transgression, the golden calf. Israel sinned a great sin at Mount Sinai, and because of that, God added a law which came into existence right there at Mount Sinai. It was the law that came into effect 430 years after Abraham, and that wasn't the Ten Commandments. Abraham himself is credited by God as keeping my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. That's in Genesis chapter 26 and verse 5. So obviously, not only was law in a general sense in existence around Abraham, but even a system of laws was in place around the time of Abraham. But this law came into existence 430 years after Abraham, and it did so because of transgression. And it served as a tutor to bring them to Christ. Now, what law, springing into existence at Mount Sinai, given birth to it at Mount Sinai, would be a detailed instructor that would act out very meticulously the very work of Jesus Christ as our sacrifice? Well, it's the sacrificial Levitical system, of course. That is the system that came into existence at Mount Sinai, and it was born at Mount Sinai. Now, if you were to quickly browse through the rest of Exodus, you go all the way down to Numbers, and what you can see, there are subheadings that were added by the translators. And if you just read the subheadings, you can quickly see it's a detailed instruction of all the stuff that came into existence at Mount Sinai. The tabernacle, the table of showbread, the golden lampstand, the curtains, the altar. We can read all about that in detail until we come all the way down to Exodus chapter 40. And let's turn over there. Let's go to Exodus, the 40th chapter. Because here in Exodus chapter 40, we come to a startling discovery. Let's notice it in verse 17. Exodus 40 and verse 17, "And it came to pass in the first month of the second year, on the first day of the month, that the tabernacle was raised up." I hope you can see the implication of this, the importance of this. A full year has passed since Moses went up on that mountain. A full year since Israel sinned a great sin. A full year since the original ratification of that covenant between God and Israel, that they would be his people, his special treasure on the earth, if only they would obey his voice. Now, Jeremiah told us in his 7th chapter when he said, "I didn't speak to the children of Israel concerning burnt offerings and sacrifices, but this is what I said to them, that they should obey my voice and I would be their God." A full year has passed since God said, "Obey my voice and I will be your God." And what happens a full year later? A tabernacle is raised up. It's an added law. It was added a year later. And it was added because of disobedience until the seed should come. It was the added law that served as a tutor to bring them to Christ. The Levitical system. That is Mount Sinai, not the Ten Commandments. Let's go over to Numbers chapter 10. Numbers, the 10th chapter. Again, we started out at Exodus chapter 19. Israel arrived at Mount Sinai. That's the starting point. To get to the end, to understand everything that happened there at Mount Sinai, we're trying to define what is Mount Sinai. It starts at Exodus chapter 19, and then we're going to go all the way down to Numbers chapter 10. Let's notice verse 11. "Now it came to pass on the 20th day of the second month, in the second year, that the cloud was taken up from above the tabernacle of the testimony, and the children of Israel set out from the wilderness of Sinai on their journeys. Then the cloud settled down in the wilderness of Paran." So they started out for the first time according to the command by the Eternal by the hand of Moses. A full year, 1 month, and 20 days they spent at Mount Sinai. The Ten Commandments did not originate at Mount Sinai, but what did originate there was a covenant between God and the nation of the physical nation of Israel. That relationship was immediately marred by a great disobedience, which resulted in an added law known as the Levitical administration. Plan B for Israel. If you believe what Jeremiah wrote in the seventh chapter of his book, that burnt offerings and sacrifices were not what he had in mind when he took Israel by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt, then you realize that the Levitical administration was plan B, and it was an added law. It sprang into existence 430 years after Abraham at the foot of Mount Sinai. And now I think I have a better understanding of why Paul used Mount Sinai as a symbolic picture of the bondage that the Galatian circumcision party was trying so hard to embrace. You know, my thinking was flawed. Even though I knew that the Levitical system was an added law, yet I was still mistakenly connecting God's law, the Ten Commandments, as the icon for Mount Sinai. And that's not right. That can't be right. Let's finish this discussion with Hebrews chapter 8. Hebrews the 8th chapter. We'll just start reading right there in verse 1. Hebrews chapter 8 and verse 1. Now this is the main point of the things we are saying. We have such a high priest who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens, a minister of the sanctuary and of the true tabernacle which the Lord erected and not man. For every high priest is appointed to offer both gifts and sacrifices. Therefore it is necessary that this one also have something to offer. For if he were on the earth, he would not be a priest, since there are priests who offer the gifts according to the law, who serve the copy and shadow of the heavenly things, as Moses was divinely instructed when he was about to make the tabernacle. For he said, "See that you make all things according to the pattern shown you on the mountain." But now he has obtained a more excellent ministry, inasmuch as he is also mediator of a better covenant, which was established on better promises. For if that first covenant had been faultless, then no place would have been sought for a second. Because finding fault with them, he says, "Behold, the days are coming, says the Eternal, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day when I took them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt, because they did not continue in my covenant. And I disregarded them, says the Eternal. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, says the Eternal. I will put my laws in their mind, and I will write it on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people." This is what God wanted back there in Exodus when he said, "Obey my voice and be my people." He wanted them to have his laws written on their hearts and minds. Does that sound like bondage to you? Is that the bondage of being under the law? What is written here in Hebrews chapter 8. Don't be derailed by Paul's hard-to-understand writings. Let the rest of the scriptures guide you and instruct you as to what is clear. This is the new covenant. "None of them shall teach his neighbor, and none his brother, saying, 'Know the Eternal,' for all shall know me, from the least of them to the greatest of them. For I will be merciful to their unrighteousness, and their sins and their lawless deeds I will remember no more." In that he says a new covenant, he has made the first obsolete. Now what is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away. What grows old and vanishes away? The rituals given at Mount Sinai. You can keep reading about that all the way through chapter 9, but let's drop down to verse 10 of chapter 9. There's just one more verse that I want to read there. Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 10. "Concerned only with foods and drinks, various washings, fleshly ordinances imposed until the time of Reformation." That is the sacrificial system. That is circumcision. That's Mount Sinai. And thinking that we could be justified from our sins apart from the sacrifice of Jesus Christ through becoming circumcised and becoming a proselyte Jew, well, that's bondage. That's Hagar. And that's death. Paul's writings are hard to understand.